I need to begin this morning with a bit of an apology. This is a sermon on John 18, 15 to 27, which is John's account of Peter's denial of Jesus, his threefold denial. And I'm apologizing because we're not going to talk very much about that. We're going to talk about things related to it, but we'll spend relatively little time talking about it. And that's entirely my decision, so if you find this sermon unhelpful or irrelevant, that's all on me, which is why I'm beginning with an apology. You had every right to expect a sermon on Peter's denial of Christ, and I'm the one who's switching it up. I acknowledge that up front. Apologies in advance if you do not find it worthwhile, though of course I hope you will. And to make matters worse, I'm going to try your patience even further by raising and answering a question not only unrelated to Peter's denial of Christ, but seemingly unrelated to the Christian life at all. And that is, what is the greatest team in NFL history? The Packers of the 60s won the first two Super Bowls, 67 and 68. In addition to three NFL championships earlier in that decade, so they're on the short list. The Steelers of the 70s are in the discussion, winning four Super Bowls in that decade. In the 80s, it was the Niners who won four Super Bowls. The Cowboys of the 90s won three Super Bowls in 4 years. And since 2000, one has to acknowledge the New England Patriots, who have gone to 8 Super Bowl. I'm with you, Rod. Amen. But we have to. They have gone to 8 Super Bowls and won 5 of them. They're all great teams. And frankly, I don't think you can meaningfully answer the question which particular team was best. But I raised the question to make this point. There's a team that's not on that list that should be. And that is the Buffalo Bills, who from the 1990 season to the 1993 season went to 4 Super Bowls in a row and lost every one of them. If you're a football fan, wide right says it all. They missed a last-minute game-winning field goal in the first of those Super Bowls and lost the others in ways that weren't that close. So the Buffalo Bills lost 4 Super Bowls in a row. What losers? Why would I suggest a bunch of losers deserve consideration among the greatest teams of all time? Well, consider how good you have to be to lose the Super Bowl. There's 32 teams in the NFL. Every year, 30 of them aren't good enough to lose the Super Bowl. But the Bills were, not once, not twice, not 3 times, but 4 years in a row. No other team in history has gone to the championship game 4 years in a row. The perseverance, the character, the blood, sweat, and tears required to climb the hill after you've been pushed back, and to climb it again after you've been pushed back again, and to climb it yet again after you have been pushed back yet again, is completely off the charts. It's unprecedented. That's why those Buffalo Bills belong in any discussion about the greatest teams of all time, even though on the surface they're losers. Well, as I said, we'd spend a little time on the text, which is John 18, 15 through 27. Filling in the backstory, the Roman soldiers and temple guards have seized Jesus after he made a point of ensuring the disciples would go free. That's verse 8. I have told you that I am he, therefore if you seek me, let these go their way. Well, they did indeed go their way. Matthew telling us 26:56. Then all the disciples forsook him and fled. They scattered. They skedaddled. They ran away as fast and as far as they could. Yet our text begins, John 18:15, Simon Peter followed Jesus, and so did another disciple. There's 11 now that Judas is gone, and they all ran for cover. But two of them quickly composed themselves, linked up, and turned back to follow Jesus. Simon Peter and another disciple, that's John, our author. You'll recall he doesn't refer to himself by name. Usually he's the disciple whom Jesus loved, but here he's just another disciple, the one who's not Peter. Continuing in verse 15. Now that disciple was known to the high priest and went with Jesus into the courtyard of the high priest. We have no reliable information about that fascinating factoid, but somehow John was known by Annas and his household. So he was permitted to accompany the soldiers who had Jesus into the courtyard, but Peter was left outside. Verse 16. Then the other disciple, who was known to the high priest, went out and spoke to her who kept the door and brought Peter in. Then the servant girl who kept the door said to Peter, "You are not also one of this man's disciples, are you?" He said, "I am not." Now the servants and officers who had made a fire of coals stood there, for it was cold, and they warmed themselves, and Peter stood with them and warmed himself. John is closer to the action in the house, perhaps in the room where Jesus stands before Annas, but Peter's outside in the courtyard, huddled by the fire, because he's cold. Colder than he's been in a long time. We pass over verses 19 to 24, which we covered last week, resuming at verse 25. Now Simon Peter stood and warmed himself. Therefore they said to him, "You are not also one of his disciples, are you?" He denied it and said, "I am not." One of the servants of the high priest, a relative of him whose ear Peter cut off, said, "Did I not see you in the garden with him?" Peter denied again, and immediately a rooster crowed. John leaves it there, Matthew noting 26:75. Then Peter remembered the word of Jesus who had said to him, "Before the rooster crows, you will deny me three times." So he went out and wept bitterly. It's a very sad story, but it is also a very simple story. There is no mystery whatsoever. We know who, Peter, we know what, denied Jesus, and we know why, because he was scared. If you're familiar with the Gospels, you'll have a sense of Peter's personality. He's big and bold, almost jumps off the page. You never have to wonder what he's thinking, because he tells you. You never have to wonder how he's feeling, because he shows you. He's a natural leader, Jesus' chosen leader of the disciples. A man of action, never in danger of overthinking a matter. He rather tends to the other extreme, that is, not to think at all. He's proud, overconfident. A psychologist would say he had poor impulse control. In modern slang, we'd say he thinks he's all that. But whatever his flaws, you could not possibly confuse him with anybody else. He is completely, humorously, and tragically himself. His impulsive overconfidence leads him to veer time and again from one extreme to the other, from brilliance to stupidity, from faith to doubt, and as so evident here, from courage to cowardice. 20, 30 minutes ago, he led an attack on a vastly superior armed force, composed not just of the temple guard, but also of Roman troops. He led the attack. Nobody followed him, but he led it, drew his sword, and tried to kill those who were threatening his beloved Jesus. He was all in, ready to fight and die. Peter was not a master swordsman, stepping out to impress them with his skill. He was a fisherman who, when his precious Jesus was threatened, true to form, didn't huddle up with the guys and vote on a plan. He went for it, put himself between Jesus and the threat, not saying, but showing, if you're going to take Jesus, it'll be over my dead body. And he meant it. Meant it as much as you've ever meant anything in your life. Little thought experiment here. Imagine Peter had been cut down when he attacked. Everything else remains the same, but Malchus or somebody gets in a lucky thrust and drops him. The image of Peter on the night Jesus was betrayed would be entirely different. He'd be a tragic hero instead of a shameful coward. Yet it's the same guy. He actually did risk that. He just didn't die at the right time. As Napoleon observed, from the sublime to the ridiculous is but a single step. And rather than heroically dying or initiating the apocalyptic battle he envisioned, Peter merely succeeded in cutting off somebody's ear. And splashes of color unique to John, we're told that it was Peter who did that, nobody else identifies him. We're told the name of the man whose ear he cut off, Malchus. And that sets us up for the topper, which is for the third denial standing around the fire, it was a relative of Malchus who had been in the garden who said, in effect, wasn't that you with the sword? Well, those are the facts. And again, my apologies, we won't be talking much more about them. I also said last week we'd address the issue of harmonizing the various accounts, but in light of the direction I've chosen, we won't be doing that today either. 1,000 pardons. Now let me tell you why we're going where we're going. As I said, this story is very sad and very simple. Peter denied Jesus, and we know why. He was scared, shell-shocked. And, prying a little deeper, he was overconfident. Could not imagine any possible situation where he would deny Jesus, even though Jesus had expressly warned him of it. He was not aware enough of the sin, the flaws, and the weakness he carried around within himself. Being a dynamic impact type person, he was very aware of what's going on out there, wanted to make that right, but was not aware of what was going on in here. And it caught up with him big time. So, we are all aware that it's a very bad, very wrong thing to deny Jesus. We are supposed to be his witnesses, testifying to our knowledge of and relationship with him. Being silent is bad enough, but to actively lie, explicitly deny you know him, that takes failure to a whole nother level, which Peter has demonstrated for us. And we understand why he failed. It was the overconfidence. 30 minutes earlier, he was ready to take on the Roman Empire for Jesus or die in the attempt. But times have changed. And frankly, it is difficult for us to comprehend how much times had changed. The husband or wife unexpectedly informed of their spouse's infidelity. The phone call about the fatal car accident. The catastrophic diagnosis about the niggly little thing you finally had the doctor look at. These get us in the ballpark. Without warning, out of the blue, the world is turned upside down. Then what? Psalm 46 begins, God is our refuge and strength, a very present help in trouble. Therefore, we will not fear, even though the earth be removed, and though the mountains be carried into the midst of the sea. Wonderful sentiment, very picturesque, the earth giving way, the mountains plunging into the sea. It's one thing to recite that with the earth firm beneath your feet and the mountains nice and still. Quite another when the earth trembles and you see the mountains move. At that point, will you or will you not fear? Tell you something I know. I know there's no way to know until you've had the earth tremble under your feet and seen the mountains move. Some of you humble souls might surprise yourselves. Others, bolder, might be in for a surprise of a different sort. Well, the earth shook and the mountains moved, and Peter feared. He was tested and failed, weighed in the balance and found wanting. And I think every one of us understands what happened and why. Does anybody here think, oh, I'd have nailed that, I'd have stood tall and been fine? This is my point. We all know this. This is why I want to talk about something else, a different aspect of the story, the subtext, so to speak. Because Peter, God bless him, is so obvious and so transparent and so easy to understand. There's parts of the story we don't pay any attention to, wouldn't think about them in a million years. It's like Peter's got a kick me sign on him. Have you ever seen this? Very sophisticated trick. You write kick me on a sheet of paper and then, unbeknownst to someone, tape it on their rear end. Highbrow it is not. Funny it is, because they don't know it's there, and it's rather difficult to concentrate on anything else or take them very seriously until they have discovered and removed the kick me sign. Well, this morning, I want us to look past the kick me sign on Peter's rear end and focus our attention on another aspect of the story, which I'll introduce this way. Frankly, I don't think most of us are good enough to make the mistake he made. In regard to this particular event, most of us aren't brave enough to be cowards at that level. Since I'm the one veering off the main thrust of the text, I'll just phrase it personally and leave it to you to insert your name here if it belongs. I'm not good enough to make the mistake he made. I'm not brave enough to put myself in the situation where he folded. Where was Peter's brother, Andrew? John's brother, James? He was sidling up for the number one or two spot in the kingdom just last week. He is nowhere in sight at the moment. Where's Philip, Matthew, Thomas, Simon the Zealot? As Matthew himself testifies, all the disciples forsook him and fled. They were running into the night, tripping over things and scrambling, maybe crawling to get away. Maybe one of them found a good hiding spot and another came up and said, let me hide with you. And he said, no, there's no room. Go find your own spot. I don't know. Wouldn't surprise me. All 11 fled initially, and 9 of them just kept running. At that moment in his ministry, Jesus had a grand total of 2 followers. One of them was John, and the other was Peter. This is what I'm talking about when I say I doubt I'm good enough to fail as he did. On the surface, you look at the event and you say, okay, I do not want to be like Peter. That's obviously correct at the level it's correct, but it is painfully obvious. So trite, it seems a waste of time to talk about it. That's why I want to shake things up and challenge us to be more like Peter. Because it would be a spectacular step up for me to fail at his level of failure. But in order to do this, we've got to see past the kick me sign. Show you what I mean in a different context. One of the signs John records, chapter 6, is Jesus walking on water, though this is an aspect of the event John did not record. You'll recall the disciples were crossing the Sea of Galilee when a big storm whipped up. It was the middle of the night, and they were in the middle of the sea. Their lives were in very real danger. Jesus came to them walking on the water, and when they saw him, they were afraid. Here's how John puts it, chapter 6, beginning at verse 19. So when they had rowed about 3 or 4 miles, they saw Jesus walking on the sea and drawing near the boat, and they were afraid. But he said to them, "It is I, do not be afraid." Then they willingly received him into the boat. Simple enough. They see him, they're afraid. He says, verse 20, "It is I, do not be afraid." Verse 21, they willingly received him into the boat. All well and good. But Matthew tells us something that happened in between verses 20 and 21 of John. Here's Matthew chapter 14, beginning at verse 25. Now in the fourth watch of the night, Jesus went to them walking on the sea. And when the disciples saw him walking on the sea, they were troubled, saying, "It is a ghost," and they cried out for fear. But immediately Jesus spoke to them, saying, "Be of good cheer, it is I, do not be afraid." That's where John then just tells us they willingly received him into the boat. Matthew adds more detail. Immediately Jesus spoke to them, saying, "Be of good cheer, it is I, do not be afraid." And Peter answered him and said, "Lord, if it is you, command me to come to you on the water." So he said, "Come." And when Peter had come down out of the boat, he walked on the water to go to Jesus. But when he saw that the wind was boisterous, he was afraid, and beginning to sink, he cried out, saying, "Lord, save me." And immediately Jesus stretched out his hand and caught him and said, "O you of little faith, why did you doubt?" Then they got into the boat. So as we read it in Matthew, it seems like even Jesus is piling on Peter. "O you of little faith, why did you doubt?" Peter did, in fact, take his eyes off Jesus. He did, in fact, begin to sink. That's the kick me sign. It's there. Did you notice anything else? John wasn't rebuked for little faith. Thomas wasn't rebuked for little faith. Matthew wasn't rebuked for little faith. None of the other disciples got the rebuke Peter earned. Why? Because they had such great faith? No. Because they wouldn't even get out of the boat. None of the rest of them attained the level where they could fail like Peter did. Understand that in all of human history, there are only 2 people who have walked on water, and Peter is the other one. Yes, I know he began to sink, but before he did that, unlike everybody else, he got out of the boat. Yes, I know he denied Jesus, but before he did that, unlike everybody else except John, he turned around and followed him. I am not trying in any way to lessen or minimize the catastrophic failure of denying Jesus. I'm just trying to put it in context so that instead of simply seeing what Peter did wrong, your consciousness also registers what he had done right. So that as you reflect on Peter, you don't regard yourself as successful because you didn't make his mistake. That'd be like the disciples who stayed in the boat congratulating themselves on not being rebuked for their little faith. As small as Peter's faith was, it was far greater than theirs. Here's what I'm after in the words of President Theodore Roosevelt. "It is not the critic who counts, not the man who points out how the strong man stumbles or where the doer of deeds could have done them better. The credit belongs to the man who is actually in the arena, whose face is marred by dust and sweat and blood, who strives valiantly, who errs and comes short again and again, because there is no effort without error and shortcoming, but who does actually strive to do the deeds, who knows the enthusiasm, the great devotion, who spends himself in a worthy cause, who at the best knows, in the end, the triumph of high achievement, and who at the worst, if he fails, at least fails while daring greatly. Far better it is to dare mighty things, to win glorious triumphs, even though checkered by failure, than to rank with those poor spirits who neither enjoy nor suffer much because they live in the gray twilight that knows neither victory nor defeat. Peter knew great defeat because he had dared great things. And God forbid that we, like twilight spirits, read his story and call it success to avoid his mistakes. Well, that is the point, but we're not done yet. There's another couple of chapters in this story. First, we'll look behind the scenes, then we'll look beyond them. Behind the scenes. All four gospel writers record Jesus' specific prediction that Peter would deny him three times. But only Luke tells us that Jesus prefaced it with this statement to Peter. Simon, Simon, indeed Satan has asked for you that he may sift you as wheat, but I have prayed for you that your faith should not fail, and when you have returned to me, strengthen your brethren. Luke 22:31 and 32. A couple of points to ensure we understand that. One, Jesus is speaking to Peter, but when he says Satan has asked for you that he may sift you as wheat, that you is plural. Satan has asked for all the disciples that he may sift them all as wheat. But when Jesus says, I have prayed for you that your faith should not fail, and when you have returned to me, strengthen your brethren, those are all singular. He has prayed for Peter in particular, that his individual faith not fail. And when he personally returns, he is to strengthen his brothers. That's one. The other is the word translated asked in the phrase, Satan has asked for you. The New American Standard there reads, Satan has demanded permission to sift you like wheat. The ESV, Satan demanded to have you, that he might sift you like wheat. There's a big difference between asking and demanding. And there are subtle linguistic things in the translation question, but I think it's much more of a demand than a request. Don't have time to explain that in detail. But the practical point is, this isn't just about Peter. This is the decisive battle in the cosmic war between darkness and light, and Satan is employing everything at his disposal. Peter's a foot soldier, just a pawn. He's a key pawn, but he is just a pawn. So Satan gets to sift him like wheat. How do you figure you'd do if Satan sifted you like wheat? The fullest picture we're given is in the Old Testament book of Job. Can't address all the dynamics, but in a nutshell, Satan asks to sift Job like wheat. Job was a very righteous man, very faithful to God. Satan charges it's just because God has blessed him, and if God were to take away his blessings, Job would curse God to his face. So God gives Satan permission to take away everything from Job. His flocks, his servants, his possessions, his family. Happens in one day, one hour. They're gone. When Job received the news, he rose, tore his robe, shaved his head, fell to the ground, and worshipped. saying, "Naked I came from my mother's womb, and naked I shall return there. The Lord gave, the Lord has taken away. Blessed be the name of the Lord." That's pretty good. But it's not over yet. It's only just begun. Satan argues Job only cares about himself. And if God were to strike his body with pain and disease, then Job would surely curse God to his face. So Satan was permitted to afflict Job with painful boils from the sole of his foot to the crown of his head. And we are told Job sat on an ash heap, scraping himself with broken pottery. His wife had had enough, saying to him, "Do you still hold fast to your integrity? Curse God and die." Job replies, "You speak as one of the foolish women speaks. Shall we indeed accept good from God, and shall we not accept adversity?" In all this, Job did not sin with his lips. Well, the story goes on, but the practical point for us is you don't want to get sifted like wheat. You don't want to catch Satan's attention and become a special project of his. Peter figured he was ready for anything, but he wasn't. Well, that's behind the scenes. Now let's look beyond them, as Jesus did. Peter's epic fail denied Jesus not once, not twice, but three times. Jesus knew it was coming, told him explicitly, "Before the rooster crows, you will deny me three times." But Jesus did not go on to say, "And that's it, you gutless wonder. Three strikes and you're out. No place for cowardly losers like you in my kingdom." I opened by talking about the greatest teams in NFL history, and any football fan could rattle off the usual suspects. But I talked about a team that usually isn't mentioned. The Buffalo Bills, 1990 to 1993, lost four successive Super Bowls. You have to pay attention to see how great they were. You have to think about it. You got to look past the kick me sign. The Lord does not see as man sees. For man looks at the outward appearance, but the Lord looks at the heart. Naming is a big deal in the Bible, the names of things. And God often changes a person's name. Abram becomes Abraham, Jacob becomes Israel, and so on. When Jesus first set eyes on that man, he changed his name. And that is big medicine. John tells the story in chapter 1. One of those who heard John the Baptist say to follow Jesus was Andrew, Simon Peter's brother. And Andrew did follow Jesus, but first he went and got his brother, Simon, and said to him, John 1:41, "We have found the Messiah." And he brought him to Jesus. Now when Jesus looked at him, he said, "You are Simon the son of Jonah. You shall be called Cephas," which is translated a stone. And I've got to explain the linguistics there. The language they are actually speaking is Aramaic. The New Testament is written in Greek. Cephas is the Aramaic word for stone. Petros is the Greek word, comes into English as Peter. But occasionally in the Gospels, the Aramaic is just transliterated straight across. That's what's going on in John 1:42, which is why it reads Cephas there. The point is, Jesus looked at him whose name was Simon and renamed him. Cephas in Aramaic, Petros in Greek, Peter in English, which means stone. Solid, weighty, dependable. Jesus didn't look at him and say, "You shall be called whipsaw, because you go back and forth." Jesus didn't look at him and say, "You shall be called cheap suit, because you fold under pressure." Jesus looked at him and said, "You shall be called Cephas, rock, Peter." And it took Simon some time to grow into his new name. Jesus knew that too. That's why he didn't say to Peter, three strikes and you're out. He said, Simon, Simon. Ooh, flagging a little regression there. Simon, Simon. Indeed, Satan has asked for you that he may sift you as wheat, but I have prayed for you that your faith should not fail. And when, not if, but when you have returned to me, strengthen your brethren. Yes, Peter denied Jesus three times, and that's very bad. He trusted himself too much, so he crashed and burned. But that is neither the whole story nor the end of the story. When we see it as Jesus did, a sad but necessary step in his growth, we find ourselves faced not with the surface question of how can I avoid being like Peter, but with a subtler and deeper question, how can I become more like him? Let's pray. Lord, thank you for your marvelous work in the life of this wonderfully colorful man. And Lord, as we consider this epic failure, this David and Bathsheba moment in his experience, yes, keep us from that failure. But Lord, can we see past it? Can we see beyond it in the way you did? To see it as part of your work in his life and the sure fruit that would be born from the lesson learned. And Lord, may we in our own lives rise to the level of Cephas, the rock. Jesus, we pray in your name. Amen.